am Queen Amidala of the Naboo. I come before you in peace.
Ah, Naboo Beacon. Yusa bring him the mechanics. Yusa all bombad.
We have searched you out because we wish to form an alliance.
Your honor.
Who's that this?
I am Queen Amidala. Huh? This is my decoy, my protection, my loyal bodyguard. I'm sorry for my deception, but it was necessary to protect myself. Although we do not always agree, Your Honor, our two great societies have always lived in peace. The Trade Federation has destroyed all that we have worked so hard to build. If we do not act quickly, all will be lost forever. I ask you to help us. No, I beg you to help us. We are your humble servants.
Welcome, everyone, from across the universe to the Wampa's Lair podcast. Star Wars is for everyone, so pull up a chair, get comfortable, and join the conversation with your hosts, Carl LeClaire and Jason Hunt, here in the Wampa's Lair.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast, part of the Thunderquack Podcast Network. This is episode number 553, Queen's Peril. I'm, as always, one of your hosts, Jason Hunt, and with me, the Captain Panaka and Queen Amidala. To my Sio Bibble, we have Carl LeClaire and Tiara from Crafting on Ilum.
Red group, blue group, everybody this way. Hey, Tiara.
Hi.
Welcome back. So excited to have you once again.
Third time in counting.
Let the good times continue, as they say.
It'll be fantastic and wonderful. What are we talking about this episode? As if it wasn't given away in the title of the episode.
Yeah, so as we kind of continue our march to the 25th anniversary celebration of Phantom Menace, we're going to look at the 2020 novel by E.K. Johnston, Queen's Peril, the middle book in her Padme trilogy, which is also the prequel book of the of all the stories in that trilogy. And Tiara, I'm so glad you're here to discuss this with us, because first off, you helped us kick off this year of celebration for Phantom Menace when we talked about why we love Phantom Menace about a month ago. And So glad to have you back on this one. I know we're going to have you back towards the end of this, at the end of May again, to talk everyone's favorite Jedi, Qui-Gon Jinn. But today we are focusing on this wonderful little story by E.K. Johnston, Queen's Peril. And if I remember right, this was your first time reading the story, right?
Yeah, I had read Queen of Shadows or Queen Shadows. Is it Queen of Shadows or Queen Shadow? I don't know if there's like a the
Queen Shadow.
Queen Shadow, yeah.
Queen Shadow.
I wish it was Queen of Shadows.
Yeah, I had read that one.
Sounds like a Sarah J.
Of Shadows, yeah, yeah. Very ominous, but also it was such a good book. But yeah, this was my first time reading it, so it was a fun read for sure.
Yeah, I think this was my probably. I know it was at least second, possibly third time. When Queen's Hope came out, which was the last book, which is an immediate sequel to Attack of the Clones. I know I read that right when it came out, and then I reread Queen's Peril. So yeah, I think this is my third read. This is probably my personal favorite of that trilogy. But that said, I'm really looking forward to having a conversation around this book. Before we get into the conversation itself, though, just want to let y'all know that spoilers will be abundant. So if you have not read Queen's Peril and want to stay spoiler free, this probably isn't the episode for you. However, if you've also never read Queen's Peril but don't think that you're going to get around to it and just want to hear a conversation around the book in general, please stick around, because kind of the point of the conversation is really to focus on some of our highlights from the story itself. I know for me, I'm going to be looking at some of the things that enhance my enjoyment of Phantom Menace in particular. But there's so much going on in this very short book. I mean, all three of these novels by E.K. Johnston in the Padme trilogy, they all clock in under 300 pages. And they're also YA, so they read a little bit faster in that regard too. But, you know, before we get a more in-depth conversation going, I want to start with you, Tiara, since it was your first time, and just kind of what were your general thoughts when you finished the book? What was going through your head?
I thought it was really fun because I always like learning more of like background stories. So I hadn't like really thought too much about the Handmaidens. And then when I read this book and seeing like where they all started and why they, you know, started to serve Padme and what went on in choosing their names and like their background and interactions with Padme. And it was just cool to see them as teenagers because, I mean, kind of what they are, like they're young adults, but they're still in their teens. And so I really enjoyed that aspect because you kind of forget about that when you watch Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
And we'll probably get more into it as we talk about the book. But the crazy thing is, you know, that it really is the events of the Phantom Menace that caused these young women to really grow up really fast and stuff like that. And, you know, we explore some of that in the book. So it's really cool.
Yeah. And so Tiara, did you read the book or did you do like an audio book of it?
Oh, I read it.
Okay. I'm just always curious how people consume things. Cause I know for Jason, it's pretty much always audiobooks at this stage of the game, right, Jason?
Okay. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. No, I'm able to make more time to listen. And you know, sometimes my work is pretty quiet and I work from home, so I can just put the audiobook on while I'm working. So I get, nice. I get through a lot of things faster that way.
Yeah, totally. I like physical books, but it's just easier for me to read it on my phone because I could like, I don't know, be out in a waiting room or something and reading the book. So that's why I like actually read it instead of listening. I guess I could do like earbuds and listen to the audiobook. I don't know why I haven't thought about that until now.
I think one of the yes. fun things about the entire Padme trilogy audiobooks, they're all read by Kat Tabor, which is really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the voice actress of
Padme from Clone Wars.
Yeah. I just want to make sure I was thinking of her correctly. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're really good and she does a very, very good job of reading them. So yeah.
And how about for you, Jason? Because like, was this your second time reading?
This was my second time reading through this book, listening through this book, and I did enjoy it. I do remember the first time being really happily surprised with how much of the book overlapped with the Phantom Menace, and then this time going, oh, I guess it wasn't as much of the book as I thought it was that overlapped with the Phantom Menace. So which is fine, but it's still all really built well together, and it seems like there's a lot of interesting moving parts with the various different handmaidens as we're starting to get to know them, because this is sort of like our introduction to all of these people that E.K. Johnston then goes further to explore some of throughout the rest of the Queen's Trilogy books that she does. But it's really a tight story and really well paced, in my opinion. There's some great moments in this book, and I really do, like we've mentioned, appreciate the stuff that does overlap with the Phantom Menace, because it definitely enhances a side of the story that we don't get to think about or don't think about as often as others. So,
Yeah.
And what about you, Carl? What are your general thoughts, opening remarks?
Yeah, I appreciate what you just mentioned, Jason, about how I also kind of misremembered how much of this overlapped with Phantom Menace, because I also thought the majority of the book was kind of this overlap. But I would say it's at least the first third, if not a little bit more, of the book is very much its own story before the events of Phantom Menace. So I really appreciated that. It really did a lot of world building for the people of Naboo. I really appreciated that. And I think this time through again, it's kind of what I would have said probably the first time I read it, which is simply, as someone who deeply loves the Phantom Menace, I really appreciate getting that story and also what precedes that story specifically from the viewpoint of Padme and her handmaidens. Now, granted, obviously Padme is the main character of the book. Sabe is probably the second main character. And then the other handmaidens are kind of equally dispersed among them. I will own the fact that I still struggle to remember which handmaiden was which besides Sabe and Padme. Yeah. That's just because I'm old and can't seem to remember anything anymore. But all that to say, I do really love how it takes this story that I know so well and gives me a totally different perspective, right? Because the Phantom Menace story is very much the story of Qui-Gon and Anakin, and Padme is kind of a secondary character. So it's really fun getting it from her aspect. And what still rings true for me is the most powerful part of the book is getting to see kind of the atrocities that the Trade Federation commits on the Naboo people, right? We get to go into the camps. We get to get an experience of what that occupation felt like for the people of Naboo. Because, of course, we don't really get that other than Sayo Bibble. The people have decided this is a democracy. Everything's outrageous.
Yes, exactly. You know, the death toll is catastrophic. We must bow to their wishes. You must contact me.
I'm quickly dialing
that
my phone.
That line is like, that line is so different for me now.
Right?
The death toll is catastrophic.
Yes.
It didn't happen. It was just something that I know of from Phantom Menace. Like, it's just one of those lines. But now it sticks out to me as like, I know what's going on there. I know why he's saying that.
Yeah. So we'll say more. So let's get into some of these fun things like that, Tiara. What was it about the catastrophic line that caught you? Because, they give it a particular purpose in this story.
Yeah, so when I read it, I was like, that's super cool, because I like things like that, like secret codes and things like that, like being like a spy and whatnot. So when they picked Cole, correct me if I'm wrong, it was because it was one of the least used words in the
toll
language.
Yeah.
So they picked it to make sure that Padme and Sabe knew that the rest of them were okay, which I have questions about, but I'm sure you guys will answer later.
But yeah, so it's partly a code to tell Padme and everybody that the handmaids that got left behind are still okay. And so Governor Bibble has no idea what it means, but he's told to tell her something, and so he does. In only the most theatrically pompous and diplomatic way that he can, which is amazing. I absolutely love Governor Bibble in this book, by the way. He gets a couple of scenes, and he's perfectly, perfectly written in E.K. Johnston's words. So I have to say that.
It is quite outrageous.
It's outrageous. It's unthinkable. There hasn't been a full-scale war since the formation of the Republic. I'm sorry. I think we're killing Tiara over there. She's
just
about to fall out of her chair.
Part. Yeah, it's getting to me.
It's outrageous. whether you have read the book or not, and you're at this point committed to hearing what we have to say about it, I am going to just give a very quick synopsis. I promise I'm going to keep this very quick. But ultimately, the book opens with Padme essentially being elected Queen of the Naboo. And we get to essentially see her in the first few weeks of her leadership. We see her, we see a little bit of her way of doing politics for the people of Naboo. She's coming from a long line of isolationism on the Naboo queenship, if you will. So all previous queens to Amidala very much were in a process of isolationism. So we see Padme open up the entire Chamel system to a summit. She wants to build allies with the other the other planets in her area of space. So we very much get to see what kind of queen she intends to be. She intends to be one that kind of opens the doors, lets others in. And everything's kind of off to a good start. And then the Trade Federation show up, and then boom, we're into the events of the Phantom Menace. And like I said, we do get to stay, because we spend so much time getting to know the handmaidens, we do get to stay on Naboo. We see what the occupation is like. And then the book ultimately ends with the end of the movie. So that's really what goes on in the book.
One of the main dramatic aspects of the book is the the pulling together and developing the relationship of Padme and all of her handmaidens as they figure out what it is that their purpose is together as individuals and a group. And that's sort of the driving drama that takes us throughout all of these narrative steps that Carl outlined. So,
It's
a very, like I said earlier, it's a very well, tightly put together little story. So,
So let's just have some fun with this. Let's start throwing them out there. What are some parts of this book that really intrigued you, you know, caught your eye?
I did like how we kind of, you know, and it was scattered throughout the book, as we would focus in on different handmaidens during the story. But I did like how we got sort of each of the handmaidens meeting with Panaka as he went out and recruited them. Mm. We kind of got a flavor of who they were, what they might have been doing if they hadn't ended up becoming one of Amidala's handmaidens and all this sort of stuff. I believe the book doesn't open with this, but the first one obviously is Sabe. And then the rest sort of gets sprinkled throughout.
Yeah. I think Jason may have frozen. Yep. He froze there.
So what's going on? So,
It wasn't even that. You're good. You were in carbonite for a moment, but you're back. All good.
Yeah.
But no, that's right. In the story kind of starts with Panaka going to who will become Sabe, because we obviously learn how all of them chose their names. But then as the book goes on, we get little interlude chapters where each individual handmaiden is contacted by Panaka. We learn what their individual skill set was and why they were invited in to be one of the handmaidens. Mm-hmm. But Tiara, I'm curious for you, what was something from the book that you found particularly intriguing?
I mean, I really liked like several parts of it. I liked learning a little bit more of Padme's mom and dad and just kind of hearing about her family and seeing her interact with her family. I liked exploring more of Naboo's culture and just kind of taking a look at like their artistry and education and how children are brought up on Naboo. And then I really enjoyed learning how they came to form the Queen's voice and who it was tailored for.
Yeah. I love that as well. And I remember the first time I read the story, and they have kind of this, we learn early on that Padme herself kind of uses a more stoic voice while she's even campaigning to be queen. And then she works with her handmaidens to better emulate this kind of stoic monotone voice, and they all practice it together. So again, any one of them could step into the role of queen as a double and use this. And I always like, I got a kick out of it the first time I read it, because I was like, is this E.K. Johnston taking some questionably bad acting and making it like make sense in canon? You know, Jason, what are your thoughts on that aspect?
Well, no, I mean, I don't know if it's that per se, but it's also the fact that, you know, Keira Knightley and Natalie Portman had to do the same thing. Mm. They had to find a voice they could both do to be Queen Amidala, you know, because, you know, we the first time we see her, obviously, when it's the meeting right before the invasion happens, that's Natalie Portman. And the next time we see her when she's being rescued by the Jedi and Jar Jar, that's Keira Knightley. In the Queen's getup. So, but I don't know about you guys. I didn't notice the difference until it was revealed at the end. So I think it's partly by design from the movie's standard, but it sort of incorporates a bit of that into, well, here's, you know, what the actual characters would have done. And of course, this was all started, you know, to Tiara's point, it was sort of tailored a bit more towards Sabe than any of the other handmaidens initially, because they started working on it before the rest of them showed up. Because, and this is one of the things I found interesting, is Panaka initially only had the plan to have a, you know, one bodyguard like this, one double like this. And then Padme was like, well, wouldn't it make more sense to have multiples? That way, you know, that way it's not, you know, one or the other. So, yeah. And that's when he went out to go find everybody else. So Padme and Sabe have a couple of weeks where it's just the two of them. And so they start developing a lot of these ideas on their own and then have to get the other girls up to speed when they show up. So they do say that some of them pick it up easier than others. So, and one of them can't get the voice right at all because she's the youngest. So,
yeah. Yeah. Reminded me of when I was in the high school, my senior year, I was in the high school production of Guys and Dolls, and they brought in a voice coach to teach us all how to use teach us how to do a New York City accent from the 1940s. And I was the only one who couldn't do it. It always came out Southern. Like I was from like I was fighting for Georgia or something. And eventually the director of the play just said, Carl, just don't even use one. Just use your normal voice. So everyone else had like this really fun, like New York accent. And then I was just like, hey, everyone. So, yeah. So luckily I didn't have a lot of lines because I'm not a good actor. But yeah, that's a great point, Jason. But I will say something that I loved that this book introduced to us also is where the whole body double came from, and it dates all the way back to a conflict with the Gungans. I loved that. Like, I love that we got it, and it doesn't say much more than that, but it gives us this little bit of sensibility around the, you know, the history of Naboo and their own tensions with the Gungans. So apparently sometime in the past there was some sort of conflict that initiated this whole body double aspect for the Queen. So it comes out of conflict with the Gungans, which I just thought was really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I really liked throughout this book is Padme's relationship with Panaka. Because it, you know, his job, you know, he's the adult in the room, literally, like, you know, technically speaking, he is the adult in the room when it comes to a lot of these scenes. And he's obviously very devoted and dedicated to his job and to keeping Queen Amidala safe. And so he's got a lot of ideas, and I don't think he anticipates the kind of, not necessarily resistance, but the opinion, the strength of Amidala in her opinions in wanting to either tweak or change the ideas. And so having them sort of come up against each other a few times throughout the book, and learn to find that balance of trust between the two of them was really a nice exploration throughout. And the big scene between the two of them, I felt, was in the middle of the book. They all sneak out after this this big summit to go to a concert. And one of the handmaidens stays back because she's not feeling well. Panaka and his wife, Mariak, catch them. And so Padme has to come back and sort of face the music against Panaka. And he starts in on her like, if you don't tell me what's going on, I can't protect you. You're not safe. And she, you know, shoots back like, yes, I am. This is something you set up. I'm with my handmaidens. They're my bodyguards. You gave me bodyguards. And it was nice to see that, you know, it wasn't a situation where, you know, the easy way in a book like this where you could have it be sort of a mic drop moment for Padme where she's like, she got one up over on him. And she slam dunked, she put him in his place and all this stuff. But she actually used all of his good intentions, everything that he had been sort of, you know, helping her build, be like, no, see, this is correct. This is right. This is what we're doing. You have to just trust it now. And the way that even when they do disagree, she's very gracious and kind about it. You know, their relationship was a really fun one to watch develop. And I really enjoyed it. So, and by the end of it, obviously they trust each other almost implicitly, even if neither of them are always perfectly happy with the other's ideas.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's Padme who says this, or I don't know if it's Sabe. The quote, "We are a powerful captain, even if it's not the kind of power you are accustomed to." I really like that quote. Mm. And I don't remember who like stands up to him, but basically he equips Padme with like these handmaidens who are her arsenal. And then, you know, after undergoing all their training and practice and working together, and he still sees them as children. And I mean, yeah, because like you said, Jason, he's like the only adult in the room. But I mean, they are powerful, and it's something different than what any other queen has done, or what maybe his, you know, soldiers or co-workers, if you will, do mm-hmm. in general.
Yeah. And he has to, you know, come to the realization that, you know, yes, they may be age-wise children, but they were all really grown up, and they have all been trained, and they're all very capable, and he has to learn to trust that process. So he trusts it, but that doesn't mean he's not going to keep an eye on it. Because that's Panaka.
Yeah.
I'll admit that this story actually makes me kind of dislike Panaka a little bit because he's so rigid. He develops this, as you both were just talking about, right? He is the one kind of tantamount for developing this whole handmaiden system. Although, to be fair, right, like at the beginning of the book, he's just continuing the tradition of let's get you a body double. But it's Padme who says, I want a team of handmaidens, right? So that's I appreciate how there's a lot of cooperation between them throughout the book, but there is something a bit smug about Panaka to me in this book that I don't care for. And I think also part of it is, you know, it also is developed in this book that Panaka has a profound adoration for Palpatine. And that's something, and I got to admit that obviously my opinion of Panaka is also colored because of in the novel Leia, the Princess of Alderaan, which I think is Beth Revis. We learn that Panaka is like a huge fan of Emperor Palpatine, because again, he's a Palpatine fan. So he's a big fan of the Empire. Like, he's fine with tyranny. And when he recognizes that Leia is the descendant of Padme, he's about to tell Palpatine, but luckily Panaka gets killed, so he can't do it. But yeah, so that book has always colored my opinion of Panaka. He's a little bit of a, I don't know. He's very comfortable with, top-down power, and I'm not a fan of that. So, but that said, I think, right, like to your point, Jason, what is done very well in this book, though, is there is this relationship that develops between Padme and Panaka, and it's one in which, right, he does genuinely care for her. He does genuinely care about the protection of her and the handmaidens. And at the same time, he doesn't seem to trust them initially. But I love like that moment you called out, Jason. I think it is one of the most incredibly powerful parts in the book, is this moment when Padme stands up to him. You know, they're all worried that they're going to get in trouble because they snuck out. But Padme kind of comes to this wherewithal of like, wait a minute, I'm the freaking queen. Like, he doesn't get to tell me what to do.
She like says something like that in her head right before she encounters him or counters his argument. I like that.
And she shields her handmaidens. She basically is just like, listen, I trust them. You picked them. I know you trust them. You've equipped them and me. You've got to trust that. And so to that degree, like, he definitely gets to that point where he inherently does. But Panaka is a little too comfortable with top down hierarchy. And I just am not. So that's my quibbles with Panaka. Maybe that
develops once he's done with Amidala. I feel like Palpatine really, really starts talking in his ear. So yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. I will say my favorite little Panaka moment in the book, though, is he's the one who calls to have the little blasters installed into the throne chair.
Yeah.
I do like that.
Yeah, that was like a little Easter egg for me, because I watched Transmenace right after I had finished the book, and I was like, that's so cool that I know that, you know, that he had suggested that. And then watching, I think, Eitre, is she Eitre?
Eitre.
I don't know who the engineer. The person who like formulated that or fixed the structure of it. But I thought that was a really cool Easter egg just to watch.
Yeah. And they, it was her idea to say, well, let's put two in there. If we're going to arm, if we're gonna arm somebody, let's put two instead of just one.
Yeah.
So yeah. It was cool that they did that. So
yeah. Well,
and then of course we see it in the movie and it's like, aha.
Yeah.
But
another little Easter egg I really liked, and it's almost like a throwaway line, but and the book does this a few times where we get like little snippets of other characters or other parts of the galaxy. And I like that the Trade Federation army that goes to Naboo was constructed on Geonosis. And I don't remember that from my other read-throughs of this book, but as I was going through it this time, I'm like, oh snap. I didn't realize that Newt Gunray's army comes from Geonosis.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a nice little Easter egg. They had a couple of those really good scenes, and you know they had them sprinkled out throughout the book, much like the introductions of the various handmaidens. You know, they'd have some with Palpatine, some with Sidious, which of course they never, as with everything that comes out around the Phantom Menace, nothing ever outright says that Palpatine and Sidious are the same person,
right?
Which I really appreciate. So. The Sidious scene and the Palpatine scenes don't even connect to each other. They're not even, you know, it's not even one after the other. So I really enjoy all that. But yeah, we got little snippets with Qui-Gon, Obi-Wan, Maul, Palpatine, Anakin. We even got like Anakin's last pod race before the Phantom Menace, and where he, you know, Sebulba flashed in with his vents and the pod crashed and he broke his legs. So yeah,
he saved the pod mostly. And we get a beautiful little scene with him and Shmi, where Shmi is Anakin's laying there in a stretcher with his little legs broken. She's, you know, kind of caring for him. And you know, I'm just going to run with this for a second, because, you know, when we were talking last week, Jason, about the deleted scenes, I really enjoy that deleted scene where we get to see, you know, everybody getting ready the morning of the race back at the Skywalker Hovel. And in Queen's Peril, we actually get to see what the night looks like. And Jar Jar and Qui-Gon sleep in the dining room area. and Shmi gives her bed to Padme. So, I mean, it would indicate that Shmi probably slept on the floor in Anakin's room, but she gives her bed to Padme, which is really lovely. It's just this, you know, this really tender moment to remind us once again that Shmi Skywalker is the greatest of all Skywalkers.
So underrated. Yeah, I love that. I loved when Padme couldn't sleep at night and she saw Shmi tinkering with the pad that she ends up using to watch the race. And I was like, hey, like, maybe this is what inspired Anakin, like, not just his natural abilities, but like his own mom, who's like good at fixing stuff.
Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, we have that scene when Anakin comes back with the winnings, and you know, he gets told that he's being freed, where Shmi is sort of working in her little, you know, home office, if you will, you know, whatever she works and fixes there. And so the idea is that she's in there with the door closed, because she can't sleep, because she's the one who worries all night about the pod race the next day. And so she and Padme sort of meet in the middle of the night and have a little interaction and conversation. And it's really, really quite lovely to have that connection, especially, you know, when we know in about 10 years' time, they would become related by marriage. So if Shmi had stayed alive, but
yeah
it's nice that they have those, it's nice that they got to have some of those little moments in retrospect for us fans.
Tiara, what's another thing that stood out to you in the book?
Let me look at my notes, because I took notes as I went through. Oh, the breathing exercises. This is just going back to their training, but it's just like the small things on how he trained to be queen and to be a good queen and protect herself and her handmaidens with like the breathing exercises and just being aware of being able to read other people, like their facial expressions and how they phrase things and the way that they carry themselves. So I really like that, and how the handmaidens could like communicate to each other without having to say anything.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's such a cohesiveness to the handmaiden group that it is. There's almost this nonverbal communication. And I think something I appreciated early in the story is all of those like little sleepover scenes we get with Padme and her handmaidens. It's this notion that they're spending a lot of intimate time together so that they can better know each other. And at first, right, E.K. Johnson does a really good job of developing those relationships, where it does kind of start as everyone is very much an individual. And even some of these individuals, they're not getting along. There's a little bit of tension in the group. But as the story continues, there becomes this cohesiveness. And of course, the Trade Federation showing up and blockading their planet brings a deeper cohesion. But a question I wanted to ask to the group here is, you know, something that I think is pretty tantamount to the book that helps to define these characters is, right, this summit that Amidala holds for the Chomel system, right? She invites all these different regional governors, regional rulers to come to Naboo, which is something that has not been done for a very long time, because once again, all of her predecessors kind of lived in this sense of isolationism. So Padme opens Theed up. She purposefully like puts herself always on like equal sitting ground. I mean, I think for me, what's really wonderful about Padme is she is meant to really be this, her mythical archetype is to be the just ruler. And she's very dedicated to the traditions and customs of the Naboo, and also opening them up and letting people experience the wonder and the beauty of Naboo. And so she has this summit. Everything is going pretty well. And there's also this great little aside scene where actually Panaka's talking to Palpatine through a transmission, and Panaka's basically raving about Amidala to Palpatine. He's like, she blows me away. Like, she's so good at this. You know, she's a very good diplomat. She's good at getting these people with different opinions together and talking, you know, like, I love that little moment where Panaka he's essentially in awe of her. And, you know, when that summit happens, we get kind of this little romantic escapade between Sabe and Harley, who's, I can't remember exactly where she's from. She's somewhere in the Chomel system, but she and Sabe like are really hitting it off, and Padme destroys it, not on purpose, but right. Ultimately she comes to Padme thinking that she's Sabe, and, you know, Padme refuses a kiss from her, and Harley's all upset. And it really causes this disruption in Sabe and Padme's relationship. And I think again, like the two of them, I think are the core of the book. It's very much about them. And just like Queen Shadow is very much a Padme story tangentially with a Sabe story. And Queen's Hope kind of does that as well. So right before the events of Phantom Menace, things are not good for Sabe and Padme. There is this tension. Curious what you both thought of that. Like, what do you think about how, you know, E.K. Johnston chooses to tell that there's this kind of disruption of the core relationship among the handmaidens right before Pudu hits the fan?
I think when I first read it, it was a little unexpected, you know, because it, you know, that everything seemed to have been going so well for the group. Like, they were really kind of getting, they were hitting their stride. Things were going well, and all this. And, you know, the assumption was, is that the big, thing to sort of throw everything off was going to be the invasion. But we add an extra wrinkle with all of this, and it's like, well, not only is there going to be this big invasion that hits, but you've also got the interpersonal problems, where Sabe and Padme are, you know, there's friction, and Padme wants to resolve it immediately, But because of who she is queen. She can't go out and just be Sabe's friend right there. And she struggles with that. You know, she wants to go out. She wants to reach out. She wants to just be, you know, be her friend, sit there and be like, hey, let's work this out. Let's talk about this. How are you feeling? But because she is queen, that creates a distance and a gulf that she can't get out of, that she can't cross because of her role. And it takes Sabe being the queen while Padme, you know, while they're, you know, they've left Naboo and Padme is out on Tatooine with Qui-Gon and Jar Jar to kind of really understand and figure out, you know, Padme's point of view on all of that. And so she comes and reconciles afterwards. But yeah, it was an interesting twist. Definitely something that was an unexpected gulf, but I think it was good because it gave us sort of another look into the fact that, I'm sorry, we're all watching Tiara's cat try and get in the middle of the cast.
Yeah, I don't. And it's great.
There's a storm, and so he's been like a little anxious. So I had to keep him there. Buddy. Continue. Sorry.
It's awesome though. We love it. He wants to contribute to the podcast. It's great. But yeah, it is nice to sort of see, to get into the mindset of, even though they are this group, this close, tight-knit group, Padme as Amidala is still set apart inside of it.
Mm.
And to really kind of understand that dynamic was good, because up until that point, we, you know, we don't really get that so much. So it was great to keep in, to get into that sort of, that world.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think of that little plot twist, Tiara?
I liked it because it showcased like the struggle, the constant struggle for Padme and for her handmaidens between their interpersonal life, like Jason said, and just being a young adult or teenager, and then also having to keep an appearance for the position that Padme carries and Sabe carries. And it's a constant struggle, like even in like just everyday life, like there you have different faces to wear. And it's a struggle to like keep who you are close to your heart, I guess, is how I saw it. Like Padme struggles to keep her own individual self and then also be queen at the same time, because she's such a compassionate soul. And it's hard to just remain kind of like this like stoic queen that we see her interact with like all the other individuals, the other representatives of the galaxy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I think the amount of work that E.K. Johnston puts into developing these relationships of the handmaidens certainly enhances my perceptions when I'm watching Phantom Menace, right? I think before this book came out, to me, the handmaidens, like, it was a cool concept, but it was very much just a background concept in a story that was very much not about them. And I think a book like this really, like, when they're on screen, I'm like, oh, like, this is this like really close knit group, and they're very committed to Padme in particular. And I think that was something that stood out to me too when I was reading through it this time. Is, you know, while the handmaidens are recruited by Panaka with the sensibility of ultimately, right, like they're here to serve the Queen of Naboo. You know, there's this kind of almost political allegiance, but I think what's interesting is that for all of the handmaidens, as near as I can tell, is their loyalty lies with Padme first and foremost. Oh. It's not necessarily to the planet, yeah, Naboo. And I find that really intriguing because it makes me think of, you know, Padme's beloved Anakin, right? That's always been one of my favorite character attributes of Anakin, is that he is someone who's faithful to people, not ideas or institutions. And it's neat to see that Padme in her queenship, in her first real big public thing in life, was established around relationships of people that were devoted to her first and foremost, mm-hmm. right? Everything else was tangential to their allegiance to Queen Amidala Padme, right? And there's a beautiful scene early in the story where Padme shares her actual name with Sabe. That was something cool that was also introduced at the beginning of the book, is that every queen of Naboo, once they are elected, takes a new name. They even campaign with a new name. And
Even as they're campaigning.
And it's a way of separating, in part for protection, but also to, you know, this is huge throughout human culture, right? Where people take new names because of a new status in life. So I like that they kind of brought that, something that's very real from our human culture, into Star Wars culture. So there's a great scene early in the story, though, where Amidala and Sabe are having this, you know, they're still very much feeling each other out. And Amidala comes to the conclusion of, I'm just going to tell her my name. I'm going to tell her who I am. Right. And it's this sign of tremendous trust. And then once all the handmaidens are recruited, she does the same thing. She tells them who she is. And it's this way of expressing a sense of vulnerability and trust. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah. The handmaidens all change their names to sort of match her.
Right.
Her name. Because, you know, Sabe is originally just Tasabin, you know, and, mm-hmm. You know, they all have different names, and I'm not going to be able to tell you any of the rest of their original names off the top of my head. But they all change their name to sort of match Padme. So that's why we have Sabe and Yane and Rabe and Irte and Sashe. I think I got them all.
Yeah, you got them all.
Woo!
Nice. Well done.
Impressive. Most impressive.
We'll if you had somebody naming interest. All of the handmaidens on your podcast bingo card, congratulations, you just won today. it's, you know, that trust is then rewarded. That trust that Padme puts into them is then rewarded by all of them, you know, giving up their names for her, in a sense.
Right.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. Yeah. Which goes hand in hand with what Carl was saying, how they kind of like sacrifice to stay loyal to the queen or to, you know, Naboo. And I liked the line where it said, if I could, Padme say something like giving Sabe the opportunity to be able to choose her own name or who she'd like to be going forward, if like this is all I can offer her because she's already sacrificing so much, is basically what that line means. I don't know exactly what it says, but basically it's like giving Sabe this opportunity to pick her own name, because going forward she won't really have an identity of herself. Her identity is going to be of Padme.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the most interesting things about Sabe and why she was picked, is that the only thing she was best at was being second best in everything that she did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is crazy, because all of the other handmaidens have an expertise. Like, they're all the best at something.
Yeah.
But Sabe is sort of like the most trusted and sort of the unofficial second in command among the group after Padme. But her only expertise is being able to be second best at everything else.
Yeah.
So
did you both by chance
really remarkable. Sorry, go ahead.
You know, did you catch how Natalie Portman was recently in, I think it was like a Vanity Fair with like Pedro Pascal, and I'm trying to remember who the other actors were in this photo shoot. Did you all see this?
I don't think so.
Did you see that short interview?
And then they asked them like who they get mistaken for.
And Natalie Portman says Keira Knightley. I'm like, yeah, Keira of course Knightley, you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's Sabe. I loved it. No, it made me so delighted. It's to the point you both were just making, going back to that incident, Jason, you pointed out earlier, which is this confrontation Padme has with Panaka after they sneak out of the palace. Padme she defends them in the sense of like, they all gave up who they were. They gave up all their dreams, all their aspirations to serve me, right? To make themselves almost invisible in service to who I am as queen. They deserve some fun. right? Like I love how she kind of uses, she admires and respects the selflessness of her handmaidens, that she also uses that as a point to stand up for them too, right? That they deserve some sense of levity in their lives.
I love the fact that that whole scene, which we've talked about several times, being probably one of the most impactful individual scenes in the entire book. It's, you got to remember that Padme is still covered in essentially a glow stick that was yep. broken and spilled all over her
yeah.
and glitter, glowing splatter and glitter from an exploded, essentially a space glow stick. So she's just covered in it, which is why she has to be pretend to be Sabe.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jason is frozen once again. I'll just continue what he was saying. And yeah, it's so funny how there is essentially a space glow stick. And I feel about glitter like Anakin feels about sand. It gets everywhere.
Yeah.
It is the absolute worst.
Do you have a lot day, of experience with glitter? Sabe.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well,
you're back.
He's sort of back.
No, I'm pretending. I'm back. Sorry.
Okay. No. You're good. You're good. I wanted to turn this back over to you, Tiara, and because I know you prepped some things yourself. So curious, you know, again, any other points from the book that you wanted to mention or that stand out to you?
Well, I have like questions. I don't know if they're like really points, but yeah. So when I was watching Phantom Menace, I thought that all the handmaidens escaped with Qui-Gon, and I don't know if I counted incorrectly, but so when I was reading the scene in the book where they were like showing the camps, and then I forget who it is that gets tortured, like obviously Sasha. That was pretty insightful to read and kind of a darker tone to the book, but I thought that all of them escaped, so then I was like confused. And Jason, you're shaking your head no, so please explain. No.
There were two. If you watch the movie, I think it's a little bit of a continuity error because they're all there at the end when they go meet the Gungans. But there are two that when the group splits up, when they're about to leave, about to try and storm the Naboo starship, there's two of them that go off with Sio Bibble, with Governor Bibble. This was sort of like connecting the continuity.
Sure.
A little bit. Because they do split initially, and there's only three of them that leave the planet, because that's all that we get on the ship and all that we get on Coruscant. But then they're all back together by the end for the fight. So, that's how they fixed it was this.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It is in the background, though. You have to really be looking for it.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's Sasha and Yane that stay behind. And as you indicated, Tiara, Sasha, there's this pretty brutal torture scene with her.
Yeah.
And
she's the youngest.
She's 12 years old. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in the way she even gets captured. So even because we don't get a direct torture scene, which I do appreciate. We kind of hear it from Yane's perspective and Mariak Panaka's perspective. And it's a very intense moment. Like they hear her screaming, and you know, of course Yane wants to go help her and do something about this. But Mariak Panaka is like, no, like she's choosing to not give us up. Like if we try to break her out, we're all going to be in trouble. But it makes the battle droids also like when she gets captured by a team of battle droids and one of the battle droids like grabs somebody by the throat and starts to like choke them out. It really makes the battle droids feel scary. And again, like I get that wasn't the tone that George wanted to take with this movie. You know, the droids obviously become more and more comical as the prequels go on. In this particular moment, they are quite frightening. And, and even in Queen's Hope, the final book of the trilogy, that's brought up again. Like Sasha very much has PTSD from that experience, which makes sense. Anyone who's been tortured will have PTSD. But yeah, you know, so like, again, like it's elements like that where, again, we're in the story of Phantom Menace, but we don't spend a ton of time with Padme doing the things on Tatooine that we've seen in the movie, but we're actually spending more time back on Naboo having to experience the terror of these ultimately concentration camps. I did want to point out one thing just as far as timeline goes. I did catch that we learned that Jar Jar had only been banished for about a week before the events of Phantom Menace, which I thought was interesting. So, you know, Jason, as our resident, as you know, the resident Jar Jar lover, what did you think of that?
It was, yes, it's quite comical because he's been banished. He's essentially hanging out around the area of the shore of the lake shore, because he's hoping that Boss Nass's temper will calm down in a couple of weeks and he'll be able to just kind of go back and apologize and go home. And then he gets wrapped up in all of this and he's taken back when Boss Nass is obviously still angry. Not going well for him, but yeah, it was good. And it was, I also enjoyed how, you know, he and Padme kind of start talking and Padme's like, all right, he starts opening her eyes to the possibility that, you know, I was so insistent on opening up Naboo relations with the other planets in the Chamul system that I completely overlooked and forgot about the Gungans that are already living there on the planet with us, you know? And so that's part of that. And then the later on, they reference the scene in the movie where he talks about the Grand Army, is what makes her realize, well, maybe the next play is to go back and ask for their help. So, and one of the other really cool big scenes towards the end of the book is the fact that the plan that she and Sabe develop to convince Boss Nass doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And Tiara, you're nodding like you want to say something. So what's going on?
I was thinking when Carl was talking, I forget what he was talking about earlier, but it reminded me of it. My heart kind of broke for Sabe because she was like so disappointed in herself that the plan didn't go as planned, and she felt like she had failed the queen and failed herself, and she was just second best again. And I just kind of felt for her in that scene, and I loved seeing how Padme improvised, but at the same time I was heartbroken for Sabe because she was just so hard on herself when it didn't go as planned.
I'll
point out, when I was rewatching Phantom Menace tonight, during that scene when Padme steps up and, you know, kind of takes over and gets things going, just watching Sabe's face, like she looks like so crestfallen. And this book fleshes that out because, yeah, like you know, you're both indicating she's really disappointed in herself that she wasn't able to accomplish this without Padme having to kind of out herself. So yeah,
but Padme does come and talk to her afterwards. Yep. Like, no, I should have built more flexibility into the plan. We only planned one thing and it obviously wasn't the right one. So we should have planned for flexibility in all of this. And you prepared what we planned perfectly, but I should have known better.
Yeah.
So, you know, she does kind of console her. I don't know if Sabe fully, she appreciates it for sure. I don't know if Sabe fully feels completely vindicated, but she feels vindicated in the end when she's able to rescue Padme during the battle, which we see in the movie. You know, she's captured, yeah. You know, Padme's captured. She's brought in front of the Viceroy in the throne room. And then, of course, we get the whole scene with Sabe running up, still decoyed as Queen Amidala, still wearing the queen's face, as they say, and, you know, has her interaction there, you know, Viceroy, your occupation here has ended. And then just, you know, spot on marksmanship with the blaster bolt to the droid head. But yeah, it was, you know, And it's that moment where she really feels like she vindicates herself. You know, Padme's already like forgiven her and doesn't hold it against her. But that's the moment where Sabe is like, no, I'm okay with myself now. Mm-hmm. I haven't failed her anymore. So.
Right. Yeah. Also just want to quickly point out too, that we, even though it's, I feel like you could pick this up by happenstance with the movie itself, but it makes it very explicit in the book that Jar Jar is the first Gungan Padme has ever met, you know? So to the point you were making earlier, Jason, right? Like she opens up these negotiations with all these other systems in the, you know, in her sector of space, but yet doesn't even think to contact the other inhabitants of the planet. So
she's never met a Gungan before.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, the first thing that she says to him is, "You're a Gungan, aren't you?" You know, like,
So, to that end, and we may have conversations about this in later episodes while we do Phantom Menace stuff, Jason, but I know in one of the earlier drafts of the movie, both Padme and Panaka had some lines that are like almost construed as like racist towards Jar Jar. And it's to indicate that like that's how ignorant the people of Naboo are about Gungans. And in one of the early script drafts, like George had them saying some pretty ignorant stuff about Gungans. But I obviously decided that was probably a little too harsh. But the whole idea was to, again, show that arc, though. Show this arc of it took Padme to be the one to finally open those negotiations. And that's why one of my favorite little, like, side aspects in Attack of the Clones is when Anakin and Padme go back to Naboo. And they're walking over the little bridge, and there's two Gungans in very much, like, Thetian garb standing there talking together, right? Because it's just like, no, but yeah, Gungans are now part of, and obviously whenever we have Clone Wars episodes that are on Naboo, we often see Gungans, you know, milling about in Theed as well. So, but that all started here. It all started with Padme, and it all started because of Jar Jar, right? We do get that scene again in, you know, when they're in Palpatine's apartment, and that's where she conjures up once again Jar Jar's pride in his people and his pride in the fact that they have warriors, that they're not ashamed to be warriors, is where Padme has the wherewithal to think, wow, this can be our point of reconciliation too, is like our shared planet is being oppressed, this is a great thing to bring us together and then to reconcile this, you know, ruptured relationship. I appreciate that the novel makes all of that very explicit.
Yeah. I guess one other thing I, you know, in this conversation I wanted to bring up that, you know, crosses over with the movie was after, you know, sort of between the scene that you're describing with Padme and Jar Jar and the time in the Senate, we get sort of an in-between scene with Padme and her handmaidens. And I forget which one it is. It might be Sabe, but asks her, so what was it like to overthrow the Republic single-handedly? Yeah. You know, like they're all sort of like, this, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. And Padme's like, it was kind of cool, but they're moving too slow to help.
Right.
Like she's like, yeah, that felt good, but it was necessary because she's got the bigger picture. Like they're not going to save our people, because mixed up in all of this, and part of why the summit happens earlier in the book is because Naboo is experiencing a crop shortage this season. And so their food stores are running quite low. And so the whole threat from Newt Gunray to Governor Bibble in the movie, you know, your people are starving, and you, Governor, are going to die much sooner than your people, I'm afraid, is very real. You know, the point of the summit was to try to open up and say, like, hey, can we maybe start getting some food from you guys in exchange for other things? And one of the planets was actually sending a shipment of food right after the blockade happened. And that was sort of the first test of the blockade to see how serious it was going to be. And obviously the ship was turned back and the food was being stored in cold storage on a nearby moon. Mm. But yeah, so the everything is on a tight, we find out in this book that everything for Amidala is on such a tight timeline in terms of getting things done, because her people could starve if things don't happen quickly. And that sort of added another layer to all of it that was sort of a sense of urgency and immediacy that things needed to happen. That obviously is a story point that's not in the movie. So that was sort of a nice additional layer to all of this, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really great how Padme kind of reflects to Sabé how disappointed she is in the Senate, that she essentially comes away with it like they're useless. They don't do anything. So,
right.
It's kind of sad, and a nice counterbalance to how she sees what it means to be a ruler. And it's ultimately to be bold, to have a vision, and to help bring others into that vision. And she looks at the Senate and she's like, they don't know how to do that. granted, it's a much bigger working body than, you know, one planet or even a system of planets. But all that to say, she kind of provides this foil of, you know, what it actually looks like to make government work. But, you know, as we start to bring this to a conclusion, once again, TR, I want to swing it back to you and ask if there were any points here that we've missed that stood out to you that you want to make sure we discuss.
This is because we were just focusing on the handmaidens and Padme, but I also really liked seeing how it was affecting the main characters that we see in Phantom Menace, like before the Trade Federation starts their blockade, how Qui-Gon kind of senses something and kind of has that like brief discussion with Obi-Wan. And then we have a little bit of snippet from Darth Maul and how he's feeling. He's so angry and has all this hatred and is like awaiting for his time to be able to be showcased. And then we see Palpatine, of course, in the shadows and kind of his mentality. Like, I really liked reading the snippet where he was determining what arc he wanted in his room, and he couldn't have it look a certain way, and he needed to like be super daunting for when people came in, but like keep them away or keep them at bay. And then he's like, okay, I'll get this piece of art, I'm just going to keep it in the storage for when I am chancellor and can put it in a larger office.
Yes. Oh yeah. No, he's a schemer. He's a schemer for sure. I guess one of the most personally touching scenes to me was at the very end of the book, when all is said and done, as we're starting to wrap things up, is Qui-Gon's funeral. Just the things that Padme is thinking about, how, you know, things that she never got to say, things that she never got to do with Qui-Gon, never got to thank him, and, you know, the conversations that they'll never have again and all this stuff, and how deeply honored they were that the Jedi Council allowed his body to be burned there on Naboo in Theed and stuff like that. It was a really beautiful way that they put it. And it made it seem a lot more personal for Padme than I think comes across in the movie, which I really appreciated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was Padme, Anakin, and Obi-Wan who like stayed until, I think, it was the last ember burned or something like that. Like they were the last ones to remain there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, fast forward a decade, and we get a great little scene in Queen's Hope, again, the final book of this trilogy, which is immediately after the events of Attack of the Clones, where Anakin goes to the shrine now dedicated to Qui-Gon, where he was, you know, where his pyre was, because the people of Naboo will always honor him for being an integral part of, you know, saving the planet. And there's a great little moment where Anakin goes back there to reflect about Qui-Gon.
Yeah. Yeah. I blanked on what I was going to say next. Never mind.
Sorry.
it's fine. It wasn't that important.
Yeah. Well, one last little tender moment I wanted to just shout out quick is at the end of the book when Anakin meets Sabe, and it's right after, you know, it's revealed that Padme is actually Amidala. And after the battle is over, Anakin goes up to Sabe and thanks her for protecting Padme. Mm. It's a really cute little moment. And even Sabe like finds it this really, and she's like, what a tender little boy. I'll probably never see him again, but how sweet. And then they have a really awkward moment together in Queen's Hope. So it's great. Oh, man. But
I actually saw a reel by her name is Isabella Amidala on Instagram. She made a reel of interaction between Anakin and Sabe, and it's that audio that's going around where it's like, you're 19, you look older, like you look troubled. And she puts it herself as like Anakin meeting Sabe or passing by Sabe. I haven't read Queen's Hope, but when you were describing that, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, it's a really funny and awkward scene, but it's really fun. It's really well written.
Yeah. I did have one question, Tiara, to ask throughout all this whole book. You know, obviously we get, and Carl mentioned it earlier, sort of we get like the sort of slumber party type gatherings that the handmaidens of Padme have a couple of times throughout the book, where they're sort of hashing things out and they're plotting and they're scheming and they're planning and all this stuff. Now, you've been a teenage girl a lot more recently than I have. How accurate is that?
See, I was very isolated, but I was in Girl Scouts, so we went camping a few times, and we were just up to, like, nonsense and, like, keeping it away from the adults when we would go camping. Like, there was this large hill, and they're like, don't go past this certain point, and I just remember, like, gathering a group of my gal friends, and we all went to the hill past the point, and we just, like, started rolling down the hill and just having so much fun, and I just... when I was reading these scenes, I thought they were just really warming and just watching them be teenagers. And then the whole aspect of them, like, basically ditching their duties to go to a concert is this such a teenage thing to do. So I really enjoyed it. And it, for what it's worth, it is pretty accurate, though I haven't experienced a whole lot of it. I do see it well represented in the book.
Nice.
Excellent.
Oh, man. All right. Well, as we kind of wrap this conversation up, and, you know, as always, like in anything we ever talk about, there's always still so much more we could talk about.
Right.
But whether you know, at this point you've listened for a little while now, so whether or not you've ever read Queen's Peril, maybe this conversation will at least make you either interested in picking it up for the first time or picking it up again. It's a really fun little story that, once again, like, I think gives us a tremendous new respect for Padme, her handmaidens, and their particular story within the Phantom Menace. I think that's what this book does very well. And I'll say, when I finished reading it this time, what it made me really want was actually a story from the Gungan perspective. I'm sure we're going to get stuff like this in, you know, another 15 years when Phantom Menace turns 40. Like, we've been getting these from a certain point of views for the original trilogies. You know, when we eventually get that for Phantom Menace, I'm sure we're going to get some Gungan short stories. But I would love somebody to have the courage, and I would love Lucasfilm to have the courage, to tap an author to write a YA trilogy, either about Jar Jar or my boy Captain Tarples or something around the Gungans. Like, let us... I think Star Wars plays it too safe by always concentrating on either straight up human characters or human-esque characters. I would love a story from the Gungan's perspective. I'd love to hear that backstory of where the disruption happened between the Naboo and the Gungans. Why do they live in isolation from one another? Tell us that story. I think that'd be so compelling. Tell me why the Gungan sacred place have human heads. You know, like, that's my biggest question in Phantom Menace. More than anything else, I want to know why the Gungan sacred place has a bunch of Buddhist statues of human beings. So... nothing.
And we've lost Tiara again. She's about to fall out of her chair again.
Oh my god!
I'm actually crying.
Those are the big questions I have. They did a great job of answering all the questions I've ever had about Padme and her handmaids, but now answer my questions about the Gungans. So, tell us about what it was like for the Gungans to have to evacuate Otto Gunga. Tell us about that terror, right? Like that's a traumatizing experience. Tell us that story, Disney, Lucasfilm. That's the stuff we really want. And by we, I mean Carl Leclerc. So, anyway, well, y'all, this has been such a fun discussion as always. Before we go, Tiara, if folks want to, you know, be up to date with the projects that you're always working on, you continue to amaze with the outfits you come up with and the shirts that you design. You're getting more and more hilarious with your reels and your stories. Where can folks follow you?
I'm mostly on Instagram, so it's just crafty_on_elam. And that's just my username pretty much all across social media platforms, on TikTok and on YouTube.
Awesome. Yeah, check it out. She painted Darth Maul in a pair of black pants recently, and it looks pretty darn cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Carl, if people want to weigh in on any of our the points that we've discussed here today about Queen's Peril, where can they reach out and contact us?
Yeah, we are also most active on Instagram. You can follow us there at The Wampas Lair. You can also follow us on Twitter at Wampas Lair, or always feel free to email us at wampaslairpodcast@gmail.com.
Yes, and any final thoughts before we close out this episode, folks?
Just tell me some stinking Gungan stories.
All right. And we are strong, and we're going to wrap up this episode. So thank you, everyone, so much for listening to this episode of the Wampas Lair podcast. This has been episode number 553, Queen's Peril. For Carl and Tiara, I'm Jason, and we'll see you next time here in the Wampas Lair.